WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Kylie Worth with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, June 27th. The western edge of downtown Bradenton is moving upscale. A developer is planning to build nearly 400 luxury apartments, street-level retail space, and a rooftop restaurant on the vacant lot where Bradenton's old city hall was. Backing into Ware's Creek, the project is planned to include a dock with kayak and paddleboard rentals and a boardwalk connecting the waterway to the neighborhood. No affordable housing is planned. Construction is expected to begin in 2026 and be completed in the summer of 2028. The City of Bradenton's Community Redevelopment Agency Board unanimously supported the idea at its recent meeting, moving the application forward. The developer, Miami-based Allen Morris Company, expects to spend $130 million on construction. The city's economic development director praised it as the first market-rate apartment project in downtown, which will help to build downtown's tax base. Do you own a blank wall? The City of Sarasota is seeking space for future mural projects in their Call for Walls initiative. The walls must be in good condition and offered for non-commercial artistic expression. Sarasota County aims to partner with private owners to expand the opportunities for high-quality art in the community. The most recent public art mural is in the Rosemary District and honors two black Sarasota pioneers, Reverend Lewis and Irene Colson. The dedication ceremony for this new public art mural will take place July 3rd. To learn more about the Calls for Walls initiative or have your blank wall be considered for the next mural, you can email publicart@sarasotafl.gov. Beginning July 1st, passengers can board Breeze Route 99 for free. Previously, the fare was $1.50, but funding from the Florida Department of Transportation will make this route free of charge. The bus travels from downtown Sarasota to downtown Bradenton, and you can catch one every half hour on weekdays. Notable stops include the Ringling College of Art and Design, SRQ Airport, New College, USF Sarasota Manatee, and State College of Florida. Free bus fare on Route 99 will make the lives of students on a budget a whole lot easier. Don't forget to thank your bus driver. This has been Kylie Worth with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, June 20th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. By now, most people have heard of Alligator Alcatraz being built in the Everglades to house undocumented immigrants. ICE, with the help of Florida law enforcement officials, are breathlessly rounding up to comply with the promise of he who would be king to deport them all. But the space, which was named Alcatraz, is a nod to the island prison off the coast of California that was famously guarded by frigid seas patrolled by sharks, because it is surrounded by equally inhospitable swamps inhabited by alligators and snakes that will ostensibly prevent these bloodthirsty criminals from escaping. One big difference in two situations is that the original Alcatraz did house the worst of the worst murderers, rapists, and thieves, while the only crime, though sent to the Florida version, is trying to find a better life for themselves and their families. As we are learning, many of those so-called criminals are family men and women trying to earn a living and attempting to navigate our broken system of legal immigration. And, of course, the cruelty element required by this administration will be fulfilled naturally by the steamy hot and getting hotter Florida summer weather, sans air conditioning. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear co-host Steve Norris's conversation with show favorite Mel Goodman, professor, author, and former CIA analyst who discusses the mess that is U.S. foreign policy these days. But first, hear how DOGE cuts to cybersecurity agencies and the government could not have come at a worse time. Hackers back in Tehran have targeted U.S. banks, defense contractors, and oil industry companies following American strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. But so far, have not caused widespread disruptions to the critical infrastructure or the economy. But that could change if the ceasefire between Iran and Israel collapses, or if the independent hacking groups supporting Iran make good on promises to wage their own digital conflict against the U.S., analysts and cyber experts say. The U.S. strikes could even prompt Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea to double down on investments in cyber warfare, according to Arne Bellini, a tech entrepreneur and investor. Bellini noted that hijacking operations are much cheaper than bullets, planes, or nuclear arms, what defense analysts call kinetic warfare. America may be the militarily dominant, he said, but its reliance on digital technology poses a vulnerability. We just showed the world, you know, you don't want to mess with us kinetically, Bellini, CEO of Bellini Capital, said, but we are wide open digitally. We are like Swiss cheese. Two pro-Palestinian hacking groups claim they targeted more than a dozen aviation firms, banks, and oil companies following the U.S. strikes over the weekend. The hackers detailed their work in a post on the Telegram messaging service and urged other hackers to follow their lead, according to researchers at the Site Intelligence Group, which tracks the group's activities. The attacks were denial of service attacks, in which hackers tries to disrupt a website or online network. We increase attacks from today, one hacker group known as Mysterious Team posted this week. Federal authorities say they are on guard for additional attempts by hackers to penetrate U.S. networks. The Department of Homeland Security issued a public bulletin Sunday warning of increased Iranian cyber threats. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency issued a statement Tuesday urging organizations that operate critical infrastructure like water systems, pipelines, or power plants to stay vigilant. While it lacks the technical abilities of China or Russia, Iran has long been known as a chaos agent when it comes to using cyber attacks to steal secrets, score political points, or frighten opponents. Cyber attacks mounted by Iran's government may end if the ceasefire holds and if Tehran looks to avoid another confrontation with the U.S., but hacker groups could still retaliate on Iran's behalf. In some cases, these groups have ties to military or intelligence agencies. In other cases, they act independently. More than 60 such groups have been identified by researchers at the security firm TrustWave. Calls to bolster America's digital defense come as the Trump administration has moved to slash some of the cybersecurity programs as part of its effort to shrink the size of government. CISA has placed staffers who work on election security on leave and cut millions of dollars in funding for cybersecurity programs for local and state elections. The CIA, NSA, and other intelligence agencies have also seen reductions in staffing. Trump abruptly fired General Timothy Haig, who oversaw the NSA and the Pentagon Cyber Command. The Israel-Iran conflict shows the value of investments in cybersecurity and cyber offense, Mador said. He said Israel's strikes on Iran, which included attacks on nuclear scientists, required sophisticated cyber espionage that allowed Israel to track its targets. Expanding America's cyber defenses will require investments in education as well as technical fixes to ensure connected devices or networks aren't vulnerable, said Bellini, who recently contributed $400 million towards a new cybersecurity center in the University of South Florida. There is a new arms race when it comes to cyber war, Bellini said, and it's a contest America can't afford to lose. It's Wile E. Coyote versus a Roadrunner, Bellini said. It will go back and forth, and it will never end. Efforts by the current administration to eliminate the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau are already costing Americans. President Donald Trump's rapid pullback of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has cost Americans at least $18 billion in higher fees and lost compensation for consumers allegedly cheated by major companies, according to an analysis released June 24th by two organizations. The increased consumer costs from the CFPB's rollback of regulations on bank fees, wholesale dismissal of cases against banks and other lenders, and the apparent failure to disburse funds intended for harmed borrowers run counter to Trump's campaign pledges to ease the cost of living, according to the Student Borrower Protection Center and the Consumer Federation of America. Representatives for the White House and the CFPB did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Since Trump took control of the CFPB in February, calling for its elimination, administration officials have sought to reduce the workforce by about 90% and sharply curtail its industry oversight. Administration officials accused the agency and its former leadership of exceeding their legal powers, burdening free enterprise, and engaging in politicized enforcement of consumer laws. However, in a statement this week, two organizations listed actions Trump's team have taken that they say shifted costs onto consumers. Under former President Joe Biden, the agency had sought to recap credit card late fees at $8 and overdraft fees at $5. The Trump administration move to end those policies should together cost consumers $15 billion a year, according to a statement. The dismissal of 22 enforcement cases that were pending when Biden left office in January, including actions against JPMorgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Capital One, involved more than $3 billion in alleged harm to consumers. The CFPB has also scrapped the revised settlements it has already concluded with Toyota and the payments processor, meaning about $50 million in redress payments will never be made, the statement said. We don't need no stinking science magazines or peer-reviewed research papers because they're all partisan biased, according to the current administration. The Trump administration has terminated millions worth of funding for Springer Nature, a German-owned scientific publishing giant that has long received payments for subscriptions from National Institutes of Health and other agencies, Axios has learned. President Trump and MAGA have made a push to target academic institutions as well as research organizations perceived to be the source of so-called woke ideology, including DEI and gender-affirming care policies by withholding federal funding and, in some cases, initiating legal action. Earlier this year, the Justice Department sent a letter to Springer Publication questioning its editorial practices and accusing the publishing house of acting as a partisan in scientific debates, as well as wrongfully advocating for positions, according to one source with a knowledge of the matter. The letter also posed questions about Springer's alleged ties to China, CCP funding, and related claims of censorship. At least one scientific journal, Chest, has also received a letter about taking sides in scientific debates, as the Washington Post reported in April. Springer Nature has more than 3,000 journals and publications in its portfolio, includes Nature and Scientific American. The editorial content ranges from science and medical news to peer-reviewed research papers written by scientists. The company went public last October. Prior to the administrative action, Donald Trump Jr. had tweeted, "No more taxpayer money for woke publishers," linking to a Breitbart story about possible cuts to government-funded subscriptions for scientific and medical journals. About $20 million in grants covering subscriptions have been cut, with billions more being evaluated, according to the source. Springer Nature declined to comment. Spokespersons for the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services didn't respond to requests for comment. Over the last year, Springer Nature has issued hundreds of retractions of faulty research that it published in open access journals due to compromised peer-reviewed processes and other quality and reliability concerns. The company this month announced a new transparent peer review process for research papers accepted for publication in Nature. Free speech advocates have questioned the propriety of the Trump administration alleging bias and whether that could have a chilling effect on editorial decisions. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WVPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Consistent with the battle against verified science, the group appointed to make recommendations about vaccines lacks expertise. Senator Bill Cassidy called for a meeting of a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Vaccine Advisory Committee set for this week to be postponed, citing a lack of experience among its new appointees. The new Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices panel selected by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was scheduled to meet for the first time this week, but Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana, a physician and chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, warned against that in a post on X. Cassidy said that while Kennedy's picks for the ACIP panel have scientific credentials, he warned that many do not have significant experience studying microbiology, epidemiology, or immunology. In particular, some lack experience studying new technologies such as mRNA vaccines and may even have a preconceived bias against them. Robust and transparent scientific discussion is important, so long as it's rooted in evidence and understanding. Otherwise, ACIP's recommendations could be viewed with skepticism, which will work against the success of this administration's efforts, he concluded. The ACIP's role is to make vaccine recommendations and create the National Childhood Vaccination Schedule. Cassidy voted to confirm Kennedy as the Health and Human Services Secretary, a decision after he said Kennedy told him he would not shake up the ACIP, among other commitments related to vaccines. This week's meeting of the ACIP is scheduled to include a discussion about thimerosal, a form of mercury used as a preservative in some vaccines. Kennedy has previously stuck to otherwise disproven claims that links thimerosal to autism. Almost all American-made vaccines currently feature either a trace or no amounts of thimerosal, except for multi-dose flu shot vials, which still contain the preservative. However, most flu shots are now packaged as single shots. The CDC webpage about thimerosal currently states that there is no evidence of harm caused by low doses of thimerosal in vaccines, except for minor reactions like redness and swelling at the injection site. It also proclaims that research does not show any link between thimerosal in vaccines and autism. Fed chair places the blame for not lowering interest rates in the lap of the one who seems to want them the most. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell told lawmakers on Capitol Hill this week that a rate cut was unlikely in July and that he was considering one until President Donald Trump's tariff announcements raised the prospect of rising inflation. Policy changes continue to evolve and their effects on the economy remain uncertain. For the time being, we are well positioned to wait to learn more about the likely course of the economy before considering any adjustment to our policy stance, Powell said in his opening statement about the country's monetary policy. Later on, he addressed his past rate cuts and suggested that they were likely to continue had Trump not intervened in foreign trade. If you look at the basic data and don't look at this forecast, you would say that we would have continued cutting. The difference, of course, is that this time all forecasters are expecting pretty soon that some significant inflation will show up from the tariffs, Powell said, adding, and you know, we can't just ignore that, but we're not. We're just saying, let's wait and see more. That's all we're doing. And if you want, if you will have noticed, a substantial majority of the committee has written down rate cuts in the remaining four meetings this year. So it's just a question of being prudent and careful. But at a time when the labor market is strong, we still don't see weakness in the labor market. If we did, that would change things. You know, we're going to continue to adapt as the data adapts. But is the difference between then and now? Then inflation was forecasted to continue to come down. Here, it's forecasted to go up by all forecasters. And again, we're not overreacting to that. We're just saying, hey, as long as the economy's strong and we can take a little bit of a pause here, and that's what we're doing. And again, and continue to adapt as the data comes in. If we see data that suggests the inflation is not going to produce big increases, you know, that would matter. And we saw the labor market weakening, that would also matter too. But we don't see those things. Trump has publicly attacked Powell in recent months for not cutting interest rates, calling him Mr. Too Late, and raising the specter of firing him, although Trump has said he won't do that. So far, more Americans than ever have health insurance, thanks mostly to Obamacare. But that is about to change. Florida's rate of those without health insurance fell by 13.4 percentage points between 2013 and 2023, the fifth largest drop in the nation. In 2013, the uninsured rate was 28.9%. In 2023, it was 15.5%. Uninsured rates hit record lows in the United States by 2023, driven by coverage expansions under the Affordable Care Act and related policy changes. Although a greater share of people now have some form of health insurance, they remain uninsured, particularly in states that haven't expanded Medicaid access. The uninsured rate for working-age U.S. adults dropped from 20.4% in 2013 to 11% in 2023, according to an analysis of census data from the Commonwealth Fund, a health care foundation. California at minus 15 percentage points, New Mexico at minus 14%, and Louisiana at minus 14% had the biggest drops over that period, meaning more residents are now insured. About 5 million uninsured people are ineligible for coverage under the ACA expansion because of their immigration status, affecting the overall numbers in states with many residents lacking legal status. Congressional Republicans have been pushing for significant Medicaid cuts and changes that could result in millions of Americans losing coverage. Florida doesn't think homeowners ought to know which home insurance companies failed a financial stress test. Seven Florida insurers failed the state's catastrophic stress test, more than double the number from the previous year. Florida's law prevents the Office of Insurance Regulation from disclosing the names of the potentially distressed insurers. Critics argue this lack of transparency prevents consumers from making informed decisions and protects weak companies. Homeowners are left wondering about the financial stability of their insurers, especially after recent market instability. With an increasing number of the property insurers flagged for insufficient funds after the state's fiscal fitness test, the call has gone out for the state to reveal more about those insurers marked for monitoring, starting with their names. The state's open records law says that the list of insurers under the state observation for financial soundness or solvency is not available to the public and exempt from disclosure to anyone who wants to see it. Still, seven insurers, more than double the number from last year, did not come out of the catastrophe stress test with the required minimum required funds, according to the latest Property Insurance Stability Report published in January. State regulators say that the exemptions to the state public records law prevent them from revealing not only the names, but also other identifying characteristics, such as how long the flag companies have been in the Florida market. The 2024 test reported in January modeled the losses of previous storms to see how companies could weather catastrophic losses with the reserve funds they had in place. Those insurers who failed to have the required funds after the test had to explain how they would address the shortfall, such as one which said a parent company had funds available. When Nancy Monte heard that seven insurers did not come through the test with minimum required funds, the Sarasota resident immediately wondered whether hers was one of them. She didn't know how much about the state of her previous insurer. She'd had more than a decade, United Property and Casualty Insurance Company, until it was liquidated in 2023, as much of the state's insurance market teetered on the brink of disaster. "We've been with our current company for 2 years," she said. Florida policyholders shouldn't have to wonder whether their insurer is just a few storms away from getting wiped out, said Martin Weiss, founder of Weiss Ratings, a Palm Beach Gardens rating agency. "The state is doing a disservice to the entire market by keeping consumers in the dark about insurers' financials," he said. "They make far more difficult decisions. They make far more difficult for consumers to be empowered with the facts, with their dollars, and reward the strongest companies and support the more robust marketplace," Weiss said. "At the same time, they effectively provide cover for the weakest companies to continue luring unsuspecting consumers into high-risk insurance that's more likely to be delayed, get denied, or even fail entirely. Three key factors about insurers should be available to homeowners at the point of sale," Weiss said. "Potential policyholders should know an insurer's history of closing claims without payment, what fees it's paying to affiliate companies, and information like the kind revealed in the state's catastrophe stress test, which is an objective analysis of an insurer's risk of failure." Fortunately, Monty had not had an insurance claim. She still feels the need to stay vigilant, though. "Like to be proactive when it comes to this," said Monty, who lives about 4.5 miles from the Gulf Coast. The Florida Policy Institute's conclusion on the current budget is that it does little for average Floridians. The Progressive Florida Policy Institute said the newly passed $115 billion state budget approved by the Republican-majority Florida legislature will do little to help most Floridians. "Our state is already projecting significant ongoing budget challenges, and everyday Floridians are facing mounting challenges just to make ends meet," FPI CEO Sadef Knight said in a statement. "This moment calls for making investments in public service, raising additional revenue, and in expanding economic security. By choosing not to do so, the legislature is putting their head in the sand." FPI researchers outlined a summary of the budget by specific issue areas. The budget, which will take effect with the July 1st start of the 2025-2026 fiscal year, remains subject to Governor Ron DeSantis's vetoes, but it would be about $3.5 billion smaller than the budget for the current fiscal year and is less than $115 billion plan that DeSantis proposed in early February. Knight said that legislators ignoring the potential loss of billions of dollars in federal funding for health care and food assistance under President Donald Trump's big bill. "There's more than a 1,000-page bill that includes steep cuts to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, and about $723 billion in reduced spending in Medicaid, which provides health insurance for families with limited income over the next 10 years. That would cost Florida about $16 billion, according to FPI estimates. Florida may also have to pay at least $1.6 billion in federal dollars for proposed cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program under the House budget proposal, according to a report by the Washington, D.C.-based Center on Budget and Policy Providers. More than 3.2 million Floridians, including more than 807,000 children, are food insecure. FPI, among 77 organizations statewide, who sent the letter to Florida's two Republican senators, Rick Scott and Ashley Moody, pressing them to vote against the reconciliation bill being considered in the Senate.
This is Steve Norris, and you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV in Bradenton, Florida. And as the world situation becomes more unstable, Trump is acting more chaotic. And to discuss this with us today is Melvin Goodman. Good day to you, Melvin.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
All right. As usual, we have you on when there's many crises and things going on. Let me remind people that Mel is a former CIA analyst and whistleblower. He's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. And he writes columns for centerpunch.org. So tell us, what is the history of arms negotiations with Iran and how Trump has made it worse again?
Well, one of the reasons why you could argue against the use of force against Iran, which is what Trump just accomplished, is that we had a diplomatic deal with Iran. It was negotiated by the Obama administration and an excellent Secretary of State, John Kerry. It was called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, otherwise referred to as the Iran Nuclear Accord. And the interesting thing about it is it was negotiated internationally. We had the support of Russia. We had the support of China. We had France. We had Britain. We had Germany. We had all the key actors in this situation who agreed that Iran should not have a nuclear weapon. But it was Donald Trump several years later in 2018, with the advice of his national security advisor, John Bolton, who was a very dangerous appointment to begin with, abolished the treaty, which Israel never wanted in the first place. And Netanyahu was the prime minister when it was negotiated in 2015, even came to the United States, was invited by the Republican leadership of the Congress to address a joint session of Congress to make his case against the treaty. So the treaty itself was one of the great accomplishments of the Obama administration, and it's a very serious international diplomatic achievement. So the greatest reason for why force was just outrageous in this particular case is we had a beautiful piece of diplomacy that was very carefully negotiated. It took a couple years to negotiate it and get it approved by the Congress, and Trump destroys all of it in a 10-minute action in 2018. So Trump did go back to the table. Qatar and Al Thani, the prime minister of Qatar, was sort of a middleman in all this. And Iran seemed to be moving toward negotiations with Trump that were going to lead somewhere. But Trump eventually decided that he was just being played along by Iran, and negotiated with Israel for this attack against all of the major nuclear facilities in Natanz, in Esfahan, and Fordow, the underground center for their national nuclear program. Now the question is, do you go back to negotiations? Do you try to deal with the problem of what's next? Because there are always consequences when you go to war. And I don't usually quote Adolf Hitler, and maybe I shouldn't be quoting him now, but before he invaded Russia 84 years ago, it was interesting that Hitler told one of his advisors the beginnings of every war is like opening the door into a dark room. One never knows what is hidden in the darkness. And so that's where we are now. Are we going to have a renewal of diplomacy, which Trump says he would like? Or are we going to have a return to military engagement? Iran has agreed to a ceasefire after launching about 14 missiles in the direction of our major air base in Qatar. They gave warning before they launched the attack, so we got our planes out of there. And it was clear that Iran does not want to get into a military exchange with the United States because the Israeli attacks wiped out their air defensive system, and the United States had no difficulty whatsoever in flying these B-2 bombers, which cost about $2 billion a plane, for a 37, 38-hour round trip to hit these three targets. Now what we're doing is debating what good did it do. Trump says the nuclear facilities were obliterated. That was his word. The Defense Intelligence Agency and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, don't agree with the president. They made that clear. They said they're not sure of the destruction. The official bombing assessment is really not complete. And the question is, since Iran did have strategic warning, Trump made it clear he was going to use military force. It was just a matter of time. Where is the uranium? Where is the enriched uranium? They have 400 kilograms of uranium stored somewhere. I doubt if they left it in the places where they knew the attack would come from. And what about the cartridges that are used to spin the uranium to create enriched uranium that can be used for these weapons? So the question now is, can we get back to diplomacy? Will Trump have the patience to deal with diplomacy? He obviously is not a very patient person. He demonstrates that all of the time. You can't get an arms control agreement without patience. I was involved in the SALT talks in 71 and 72. Those were talks that began in 1969 and weren't completed till 1972. The Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty took several years. The Conventional Force Treaty took several years. This doesn't happen overnight. But it's possible that Iran sees there's really no path to creating a nuclear weapon. They have full knowledge of the nuclear fuel cycle and can go back to it if they want. But Israel's made it clear if they try to rebuild their nuclear facilities, they're going to get hit again. And I think Trump is sent the same message. So in terms of what's next, it's hard to say, but I think jaw-jaw is better than war-war, which is what Winston Churchill used to say, and maybe even Iran realizes that if they're ever going to get their economy back to some stable situation, they're going to have to get relief from the various sanctions that have been placed on them by the United States, and that will take negotiation. I think the biggest problem is Israel has killed so many of the leadership, military and civilian, and the Revolutionary Guard for that matter, that how do you negotiate and who do you negotiate with? The government now is headed by a very old Ayatollah Khomeini, who's 86 years old and not in good health. So I think right now we're at a slippery slope. It's hard to say whether it's going to be a renewal of war or is it going to be a renewal of diplomacy. But clearly it's diplomacy that we need. That's really where the answer is to this current situation.
Very good. Let me just remind people, you're listening to Melvin Goodman, a former CIA analyst and whistleblower on WSLR and WBPV News. And speaking of diplomacy, when asked Trump why he invaded and what the evidence was, he replied he just had a feeling. So I guess the question is, if this is the reason why we're going to war, is Trump acting like a madman here?
Well, you know, the one thing that comes through in all of Trump's major interviews, particularly the ones he gave to Bob Woodward, who wrote a couple books on Trump, is that he believes in fear. And this raises the question of the madman theory in international relations that goes back to the 1950s when a seminar was held by actually Professor Henry Kissinger at Harvard and Daniel Ellsberg before he went into the Marines and was sent to Vietnam, and long before he leaked the Vietnam papers to try to stop the war. Ellsberg was a very right-wing cold warrior, and he even made the case for the madman theory, that it's very good to convince your adversaries that you're a little unstable and that you're willing to do anything to achieve your successes. Kissinger was kind of interested in that theory, and when he was National Security Advisor to Richard Nixon, Nixon himself said he too was a believer in the madman theory and had been willing in the past to threaten the use of nuclear weapons. He wanted Eisenhower to do that to defend France before they withdrew from Vietnam, for example. So obviously, Trump is someone who believes in fear and is willing to appear to be somewhat unmoored. And actually, when you look at Trump's personality, there is a real layer or a real set of data points that suggests he isn't a very stable character to begin with. His niece, who wrote the biography of her uncle, Mary Trump, made that clear, that he's not a stable individual. And right now, you have to think that he is in a position where he's intimidated the international community. I don't want to change the subject, but if you look at the recent talks in Europe, the NATO talks that Trump went to for a very brief period of time, it's clear that the Europeans are intimidated by this man. They did their best to make Trump as comfortable as he could be. They kept him away from Zelensky. They didn't want to upset the apple cart with very controversial discussions between Trump and Zelensky. They were trying to smooth these troubled waters. So Trump has used this to his advantages. And whether or not he considers himself an exponent of the madman theory, to me, that's exactly what he's exploiting. So no one really knows what Trump will do from day to day. Remember, he gave Iran 2 weeks to say that he was going to try negotiations. In the first 24 hours, that's when the bombers flew from Missouri across the Atlantic to bomb these three nuclear sites that I mentioned in Iran. So no one really knows what Trump will do. But the one thing that is clear that no one's really talking about is now we own the Iranian situation. It had been Israel's problem. And one of my arguments for not using the military force that we used is we were carrying out Netanyahu's objectives, not ours. I don't think this served our interests so well. It certainly served Israel's interests. And what frightens me is that Netanyahu's objectives are different than ours. Netanyahu's objectives include regime change, as far as I can tell. We don't have clear evidence of that, because that would never be stated anyway. But I think that's what Netanyahu wants. He wants to overthrow the government of Iran. And I don't think you can overthrow the government of Iran with air power. There's no evidence of that. And when it has been the exception to the rule, we've been left with chaos. Think of Libya and the Obama administration using air power to overthrow Gaddafi. Well, Libya's been in a civil war situation for more than a decade with that use of air power. When you think of Iraq and the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that was really about regime change, nothing else. There were no nuclear weapons, no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But we did want to overthrow the government, and we did. But now it's 20 years later, and we're still in Iraq. We still have a couple thousand troops in Iraq. When you go back to the Eisenhower administration, the origin of our troubles with Iran were 1953, when Eisenhower worked with the British intelligence, MI6, to overthrow the government of Mossadegh. That's why we're in a situation where there's a good number of Iranians who don't want to see the United States in any role of influence in Iran. Then there was the Dominican Republic, another failure in regime change. Think of what Israel did in Lebanon in 1983, and then they ended up staying there for 17 years. So regime change has brought one failure after another. And in fact, what you do when you use military force against a regime leader is you create sympathy for that leader. And I think the classic case there was John F. Kennedy in Cuba, the Bay of Pigs, designed to overthrow the Castro regime. It failed, but it did achieve a lot of support for Fidel Castro, realizing he was the only one who could save them from the power of the United States. And when you think of the power of the United States, you have to think that the United States and Israel are much too quick to use military force to begin with, to achieve all sorts of objectives that can't be achieved solely with military power. So there's a lot to learn from this situation. And the fact that we own this situation now, I think, is very alarming, because we know that Trump is not a strategic thinker. When I ask the question of what's next, I don't think Trump has bothered to even deal with that question, let alone to try to answer it. So when you think of who's benefited from this use of military force, I don't think it's the United States. I think it's Israel and the militarism of the Israeli system, particularly under Netanyahu. And the major defeat is for those people who favor nonproliferation, because there's going to be a concern that maybe you need nuclear weapons to fight off these major nuclear weapon states when you're challenged. So that could be the argument for Iran to return to nuclear weapons safely underground and resume their program, because the argument now is Donald Trump saying the program has been obliterated and the military intelligence people saying it's only been set back by several months. So where do we go from here is really the question.
All right, once again, let me just remind people you're listening to Melvin Goodman on WSLR and WBPV News today, and we're discussing, of course, the situation in Iran. I want to just head back to the United States for a minute, because it seems like what happened in Los Angeles and the Marines, et cetera, arriving in Los Angeles just predated what happened in Iran. So discuss that, and is that kind of wagging the tail here?
No, I think Trump had been looking from the very beginning for an opportunity to send military forces into an American city, particularly a blue state like California and a sanctuary city like Los Angeles. So I think the California situation was overplayed by the Trump administration. There was no threat to public safety. This was a small number of people who were protesting. And this was taken as an opportunity to send in the National Guard, federalize the National Guard, and to send in 900 Marines. It was an outrageous use of power. My fear is it will be used in other states, particularly blue states, because when I watch the actions of ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Investigative Force, they're clearly targeting blue states and sanctuary cities, whether it's Los Angeles and California or Chicago and Illinois or New York and the state of New York or Baltimore and the state of Maryland. So this is what Trump has wanted. He ignored the Posse Comitatus Act from 1878, which prevents the use of the military and domestic situations that involve law enforcement, and he hasn't paid a price for that as yet. But I think the more we see these ugly pictures of immigrants being detained and being detained with tremendous use of force, these pictures are extremely ugly. Even people who favored getting illegal immigrants out of the country, I don't think are very happy with the way it's being done. It's particularly ugly. It sort of reminds you of what fascist governments have done in Europe in the past, whether it's Italy in the 1930s or Germany in the 1930s. And I think Trump may be harmed by this. It's also, not to digress, but I think the election that took place this week in New York with the upset over Andrew Cuomo, who everyone thought would be an easy winner of the election, and that a relative unknown young guy, 33 years old, named Mamdani, won the morality election in New York City. It should be a warning to the Democratic Party that they better engage in generational change. They need to get younger. They need to get more progressive. They need to get more forceful in the positions that they take. And I think people are fed up with the Democratic dinosaurs like an Andrew Cuomo or a Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, or Jeffries, the Democratic leader in the House. This, to me, was a warning call that you better shake up your own party, find new leaders, find younger leaders, find more progressive leaders, and take on Trump on these very important issues. Because the Democrats right now seem very divided on whether military force should have been used in Iran, whether the military should have been sent into Los Angeles. They're afraid to take him on, and that's where he's been intimidating at a time where the United States' presence in the international community has been less relevant. I think the United States is not taken as seriously as it has been in the past because they think Trump believes this isolationist ideology of America first and that they have to look for other countries to deal with. That's why the Europeans have signed important trade deals with South America, not waiting for the United States. The Europeans have been negotiating with Japan on trade matters, not waiting for the United States. So, and you can see with his tariff wars that he's weakened the value of the dollar. He's weakened U.S. bonds. He's weakened the economy generally with the tariff campaign that he's on. And it's a question of relevance. And I find that very important because when we try to digest the reasons for why the Soviet Union collapsed, Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 because in the 1980s they demonstrated they were becoming irrelevant. And I'm not saying we're going to collapse. There are too many important institutions that can still exist and fight back. But we are becoming less relevant in many ways, and that should be a concern to the American people.
Yes. All right, so I think that's about all the time we have for today. Thank you so much, Mel. And I just want to remind people that there are many protests going on. For example, this Saturday at 5584 Cortez Road in Bradenton from 10 to noon, there is going to be a protest there, and people have been showing up to protest. So, Mel, thank you. If you just want to summarize and maybe give people some encouragement about having their voices known and where they can get more information.
Well, my writings are obtained on melvingoodman.com, my own website, or you can go to Counterpunch. I write for them regularly. But I would like to echo what Steve said in terms of protest activity and just getting out on the street. My wife and I have been going to these protests regularly in April, May, and June. There's a big one scheduled in Washington in July. I think it's very important to get out there because I think Trump took this country by surprise the second time around. They thought they had seen all they were ever going to see of Donald Trump, and now they're dealing with him again. So it's important to get out there. It's important to be active. It's important to be counted. And if you can't get out there, if there are things that prevent you from getting out on the street, send money to these groups like the American Civil Liberties Union or Mark Elias's democracy movement. It's a crucial time as we are on a countdown just a year or so now for the House and Senate elections in 2026 because if we ignore what Trump is doing, he's taking us backwards. If you look at our important institutions that deal with science, that deal with health, that deal with medicine, he's compromising these institutions. So this is not a time to throw up your hands and discuss or feel that you're tired from this battle against Donald Trump. If you want to save the United States and what the United States stands for and represents, you better get out there.
All right, everybody, listen to Mel Goodman and get out there and protest. There are protests in Sarasota coming up as well. And you've been listening to Melvin Goodman on WSLR and WBPV, and this has been Steve Norris reporting.
As Florida's unofficial title is one of the top states to live in, starting to fade away. Popular moving and storage service pods analyzed its net long-distance moving numbers between January 2024 and March 2025 to determine where most Americans are relocating this year. The report shows that 75% of the most moved to cities are on the list is within the Sun Belt, while half of the most moved out of cities are up north, mainly in the West and Northeast. Pod says these moved out of cities have high cost of living, low housing affordability, increased natural disaster risks, and overcrowding. With the cost of living continuing to fuel many major moving decisions, it's not surprising that some of the most expensive metros in the country are losing residents to areas with less congestion, better access to nature, and lower costs of living, Pods writes. According to Pods, two of Florida's major cities are seeing residents leave, Tampa and Miami. In 2023, Florida recorded its third largest ever loss of residents, numbering over 500,000 people, placing the state in second behind California for most moves out. According to the Florida Chamber of Commerce report, seniors were still flocking to the state while young adults began looking elsewhere for better and more affordable career and housing opportunities. According to Pods, people are still moving to Florida, but it's no longer the hotspot of years past. Only two of Florida's cities appeared on its 2025 list of where Americans are moving, Ocala and Jacksonville. Between 2021 and 2023, the Sunshine State consistently had at least six cities on the list of top cities people are moving to. Naturally regenerating forests are often ignored by policymakers working to curb climate change, even though they hold an untapped potential to rapidly absorb planet-warming carbon from the atmosphere, scientists found in a research paper published on June 24th. These so-called secondary forests, which have regenerated themselves after being razed often for agriculture, can help bring the world closer to a net zero emissions target needed to slow global warming. Research published in the journal Nature Climate Change shows. That is because these young forests, which are made of trees between 2 and 4 decades old, can remove carbon from the atmosphere up to 8 times faster per hectare than forests that were just planted, they found. It comes as companies worldwide are raising millions of dollars to regrow forests from scratch to generate carbon credits that they can sell to polluting industries seeking to offset their greenhouse gas emissions. Secondary forests, on the other hand, are often not allowed to regenerate themselves for long enough to benefit the climate, either because they are cleared or because they fall prey to fires or pests. Across the tropics, they found only 6% of secondary forests reach 2 decades of regrowth. It's a constant cycle of deforestation, said Nathan Robinson, one of the authors and scientists at the Center for International Forestry Research and World Agroforestry. He added that their vulnerability is likely tied to policy loopholes. Robin Chazdone, a research professor at the Forest Research Institute of the University of Sunshine Coast in Australia, who was not involved, said the refined evaluation of the global carbon mitigation potential for regrowing forests has important implications that could shape new climate policy. Last week, Reuters revealed how a loophole in the Amazon soy moratorium, an agreement signed by the world's top grain traders that they would not buy soy grown on recently deforested land, has allowed Brazilian farmers to market soy grown in razed secondary forests as deforestation-free. The moratorium, like many conservation policies around the world, protects old-growth rainforests, but not regrown ones. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WVPV LP 100.1 in Bradenton. Thanks to co-host Steve Norris and Mel Goodman for making time for us this week. Stay tuned to Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.